Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell. As promised, this week we have a guest talking about a topic that we covered before with this very guest and was very popular. Lots of people wanted to know more, so we decided to ask Bill Nass to come back and talk again about reverse mortgages. This is an issue that has become increasingly important in part in the long-term care context. How do we pay for it? But also just to meet general financial needs that people have during that last third or so of their lives. Susan, let's do an introduction again of Bill Nass.
All right. Well, Bill Nass is the vice president of Gershman Mortgage and is a reverse mortgage specialist. Gershman Mortgage has originated over $30 billion in home loans, including reverse mortgages, and has been named one of the nation's top commercial services by Mortgage Servicing News and National Mortgage News. Bill is one of only two certified reverse mortgage professionals living in the state of Missouri. And the other one he knows pretty well, it's his wife, Lisa.
Now, that's interesting, Bill. You're one of only two certified reverse mortgage professionals?
That's correct.
So this is the only designation, I assume, that's really available to somebody who's focusing on reverse mortgages.
Right. A certified reverse mortgage professional, or a CRMP, as we refer to it, CRMP, is awarded to somebody who has shown diligence in terms of pursuing ethical standards, but also in terms of the number of loans that have been originated or generated.
The amount of experience.
Definitely. So we only two of us living in the state of Missouri.
That's great. So, well, we're honored to have you back. Lots of people had good things to say from your last appearance. So we're going to cover some of the same things we covered before, but even those who are listening that heard that show, it's been, a year or so ago, will benefit from a renewal of that conversation as well as, of course, the new things that we can talk about. So let's start with the fundamentals. What is a reverse mortgage?
A reverse mortgage is the means of pulling equity out of one's home. So the difference between what you owe on your home and what the home's appraised value in the current real estate market is your equity. And depending on your age, you're allowed to borrow a certain percentage of that equity. The older you are, the more equity you can borrow. The younger you are, the less equity you borrow. And that, of course, is because we base our lending on actuary figures, figuring that the longer you live, the more you're going to be using, so we provide less.
And the more risk to the lender, right?
Correct.
When you lend
risk.
Money and your repayment is further out into the future.
Correct.
So this is a strange investment, so that people understand the complexity and the rules and the regulation, I think they need to appreciate the point that you just made, and that's its similarity to life insurance in some ways, because the lender is making a bet, and they're extending money. They don't know how long it's going to be till they get the money back. It could be 5 years. It could be 30, right?
Correct. We don't know exactly how long the person or persons will be living in the home. And so it also comes into play as the value of the house at the end of the loan. The lender does not know what the asset, the collateral, if you will, we don't know what that will be worth at the end of the end of the day either.
Markets change.
And so built into the process, these are FHA, HUD-insured reverse mortgages. Built into the product is mortgage insurance. And the mortgage insurance protects both the borrower and the lender from ever having to pay back more than the value of the asset. So let's say a 62-year-old takes out a reverse mortgage, and let's say, for instance, they borrow $75,000, and they're in the home for 30 years, and that $75,000 is going to be collecting interest, and mortgage insurance is charged to the balance. That balance grows over time. Let's say at the end of 30 years, the balance has grown to $230,000. The borrowers go to sell their home, and the real estate market has collapsed like it did in 2007. What happens? Their home's value is $200,000, but they owe $230,000. The mortgage insurance that they have paid for up front guarantees that you only pay back the value of the home at that time instead of paying back a loss or having a loss. So the bank and the borrower are insured from a loss. The government is the one that's on the hook.
Okay, and let's take one step back, though, because I know that you introduced the idea that there's this government agency, HUD, I assume, that is insuring these loans if they meet certain criteria. So this is kind of a HUD-insured loan if it's a person who's age 62.
And 62 and older.
And there are other criteria that you have to meet for a HUD approved loan?
No, the home has to pass an FHA inspection, but that's really or an FHA appraisal, but that's not too much different than a conventional real estate appraisal. The difference basically is with an FHA appraisal, we're looking more for health, any kind of violations of health and safety. Are handrails are missing? Are there problems with the steps leading into the home? Cracks in the sidewalks that may cause someone to trip? These are some issues that are a little different than conventional lending as far as the appraisal goes.
So if we're just though talking about the concept of a reverse mortgage, then you could have a reverse mortgage that was available in the private sector, funded by a private company that was not insured by HUD. I mean, that can be the case, right? But it means that you perhaps would pay more because there's not the insurance that's available?
Well, yes. And by the way, that is just coming into play right now. It's called proprietary lending, proprietary reverse mortgage lending, and it's just now being introduced. The state of Missouri currently does not have any lenders that do proprietary lending with reverse mortgages. But, yeah, that may be an issue where you're not insured as you would be with an FHA loan.
And being devil's advocate here, so that people understand, a lender who's lending under those circumstances is really assuming risk in which there is no government insurer. So they're going to have to price it in a way that they feel they can make a profit given all the risk associated with when they'll be paid, the value of the home, et cetera.
Right, which will translate into higher interest rates and higher upfront costs, most likely.
So many of our listeners, will assume, would prefer to do the sort of HUD-insured reverse mortgage, and that comes with some rules regarding age and perhaps some other things, but you said age specifically and then the appraisal.
Age specifically, but let's just back up a little bit, and that is talk about the qualifications. The qualifications are determined by a credit report, which indicates to us or the lender what the person's obligations are, both from a revolving debt standpoint, credit cards or revolving debt, or installment debt, like an automobile loan. So we look at what their obligations are currently for revolving and installment debt, and then we look at what the cost of their homeowner's insurance is, as well as property taxes. We have to take into consideration, can they qualify or do they have the willingness and the capacity to meet their debt obligations and safely stay in the home by continuing to pay their property taxes and their homeowner's insurance?
Well, let me be devil's advocate. So why wouldn't I say, well, wait, this is an asset-based loan. In other words, you're collateralized based on the value of my house. So why should you care whether I have good credit, et cetera?
Because what we see, unfortunately, in the lending world is there's a high level of default when it comes to property taxes. People are foregoing their obligation to pay property taxes, and that hurts all of us. And so the lender does not want to put the government in a bad position by taking a bad loan.
So it's really just about the property taxes, not that they're a good borrower in the normal sense. We think about a mortgage. In a normal mortgage, of course, they're very concerned about, do you pay your bills? Do you pay them on time? All those things are very important. It's important in this context, the reverse mortgage context, because it can impact your willingness to pay or ability to pay taxes.
Correct.
Real estate taxes, which is your collateral for the loan.
Correct. Correct. So again, it's a revolving debt, installment debt. And there's also a maintenance and utility factor that comes into play. We take 14% of the square footage of a home. So if you have a 1,300 square foot home, we take 14% of that. I think that's roughly $182 a month is what we count, along with their installment debt and their property taxes and homeowners insurance. And at the end of the day, when we take all of those debits into consideration, a single individual has to have $529 worth of residual income available to them at the end of the month, and for a couple it's $826. So there has to be a spread. You can't go break even on trying to qualify for a reverse mortgage. You do have to have available income after you've been qualified.
But a lot of people, I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I would think that among those people who are drawn to this sort of financing source would be people who may not have good credit, and they may not be able to qualify for a conventional mortgage. And so they think, oh, I'll instead qualify for a reverse mortgage because I'm putting up my house. Is it still true to say, despite the things you pointed out, that still it's easier to qualify financially in terms of your credit report and everything else?
It's easier to qualify for a reverse mortgage than a traditional mortgage,
okay.
Yes.
And that we would expect.
Right. But, you know, hardship cases, we see them all the time, and we hear from them all the time. And I guess the reason for the financial assessment, as we call it, the financial assessment is there to determine, again, the ability and the willingness of the borrower to pay their property taxes and homeowners insurance. And if they can't, then it's really the position of the bank, or actually the position of the government who insures these loans, that maybe they shouldn't be living in the house any longer. Maybe they can't afford to maintain a household and should seek other living arrangements, is what it really comes down to.
Yeah. So then tell our listeners, what are the things that can trigger, the circumstances that can trigger that money becoming due?
Okay. A reverse mortgage comes due when the last borrower has left the home.
Moved out.
And that can be a situation where they go into a nursing home and are out of the home for more than a year. It comes due when both borrowers have passed away. When both borrowers have passed, the loan becomes due and payable. When the home is sold, it becomes due and payable.
So if they just decide to move to Florida,
then the loan is due and payable. And if they fail to pay their property taxes, which the lender has the means to check on that during the course of the loan, and if they fail to pay their property taxes, that is another
trigger
to make the loan payable, yes.
One missed payment?
It can be as simple as missing one year.
Harsh.
Yeah, it is harsh. It is harsh. It is unforgiving.
But you got to pay your taxes.
Right.
So then, again, I'm repeating some of this because I want this whole subject to be clear to people. I know notoriously people have heard this phrase bounce around a lot. They've seen people talk about this on television and commercials. Who's the guy that does from Tom Selleck. Tom Selleck,
yeah.
Talks about these. And he talks about the fact, and I'm sure it's true, that his mother apparently had relied on one of these and it turned out well. So people have heard this phrase, but they don't get the underlying rules. So people who are listening, summarizing, if you move out of the house really for any reason and you're gone for a year, that would include dying,
yep.
But it would also include simply selling your house,
right.
And it would include deciding or having to move into long-term care.
It can include that. Now, the rule is if you're out of the home for more than a year, if you go into rehabilitative care for 8 months and then move back into the home, it's fine. The clock goes back to ticking as it normally would. So it's death, sale of the home, failure to pay property taxes and homeowners insurance. And another gray area is failure to maintain the home, failure to take care of the property, because, again, the property is the collateral. And if they're not taking care of the fact that a tree falls in the corner of the house and they don't repair it, that can make the loan come due and payable.
But now these are not gotcha provisions, right? Meaning there has to be a substantive violation. This is not a minefield where someone, through inadvertence, can suddenly have their loan due.
No, not at all.
I mean, it would have to be pretty blatant, wouldn't it?
Have to be blatant, yes.
And the contract will spell out what would constitute these circumstances.
Yes and no. No, that's sort of vague when it constitutes maintenance, because it can be anything from broken windows to...
It's hard to list every possibility.
All the possibilities, correct.
Okay, so there's some good faith involved in interpreting a contract. I can tell those listening as a lawyer that the court would impose a good faith interpretation. So people then, when they're thinking about how much money they might be able to generate with this, I was also surprised to learn that there are several reductions in the amount that you might otherwise qualify for. When you and I were first talking about this bill, we were talking about, for example, if you had a house that's worth $250,000 and you have a loan of $100,000, I would say, oh, so then there's available $150,000 that can be borrowed for the reverse mortgage. And you said, no, there's a number of reductions and calculations that will limit that amount. So give our listeners a feel for what that might be.
Okay. Basically, the reductions or the amount of assets or the amount of equity that can be borrowed is tied to one's age. If you're 62 years of age, you can probably borrow somewhere around 43% of the value of the home. And if you're 85 and above, you can probably borrow somewhere next near 75% of the value.
When you say value, you mean the value of the equity.
The value of the home. So 45, 43% of the value of the home, or if you're 85, 75% of the value of the home. And the reason why you're only allowed to borrow a percentage is the basics. We haven't really talked about this, but the basics of a reverse mortgage are the money that you borrow, you are not obligated to make a payment on that money. This is money, your equity you're borrowing out of your home.
Yeah, we shouldn't leave that point out, should we?
Right. You don't.
That's kind of an important one.
That's the number one selling point.
You don't make a payment. This is tax-free. It's not considered income, so it's tax-free. But this money that you're borrowing is going to be charged interest and mortgage insurance. And that balance is going to rise over time. So again, the reason why a 62-year-old is going to be allowed to borrow less is because their loan will be collecting interest and mortgage insurance over a longer period of time. And the HUD and the government does not want to have the asset be less than what is owed on the loan at the end of the day. So again, if you're 85, you can borrow more because they figure you're not going to live as long. And so therefore, we'll lend you more because the interest and mortgage insurance that accumulates on the loan won't be as high.
So just for clarification purposes, when you said that interest will accumulate during the course of this period, some people might have thought you meant that you only have to pay interest. So let me make this clear. When you do a reverse mortgage, no payment is made. No payment is made on the mortgage, even though the interest accumulates, as you were describing, just so people are clear. You do have to pay the taxes on your house, and you have to pay the upkeep on your house because that's the collateral for the loan, right?
Correct.
So let me ask you this. If you have a house, for example, and you do have a first mortgage on it, is that an obstacle to getting a reverse mortgage?
Well, it can be. It can also be a positive from the standpoint is if there's enough equity, if the first mortgage doesn't exceed 45% of the value of the home, you could pay that existing mortgage off and turn it into a reverse mortgage. Now the $100,000 mortgage that you once had that you were making payments on becomes a reverse mortgage, and you don't make payments on that $100,000.
Now, is that what people do? So here's the question. Let's assume that a listener has a house that has a first on it of $50,000, and the house is worth $160,000. Would they go ahead and make application for a reverse mortgage based on the whole value, knowing that they're going to have to take a portion of that and pay off the first mortgage? Or would they pile this on, or pile it on is not the right word. Would this go on top of the existing mortgage that would continue to be in effect?
No, that's a good question, Joe. There can be no other liens against the property other than the reverse mortgage. So the first mortgage would have to be, even if they had a first mortgage and a second mortgage, both those mortgages would have to be retired and be replaced with the reverse mortgage. So again, yes, people do use the reverse mortgage to pay off existing mortgages. And of course, the product becomes more enticing or more valuable as an asset if there is no mortgage, or if there's a small mortgage against the house currently. Because again, if there's no mortgage, obviously you can borrow more. If there is a mortgage, then you've got to pay that off, and then what you get is reduced.
So give us an example where somebody has a value, maybe you want to use your own numbers, in which they have a house of a certain value, and I know listeners are curious, how much could I potentially get out of my house after these various adjustments that you've mentioned, and maybe some of which you haven't mentioned yet?
Okay, so let's take a $250,000 home. And you've got a couple that's 65 years of age, or the husband's 70 and the wife is 65. We go with the wife's age because she is the younger of the two. So the qualifiers are based on the younger of the two. And we take the wife's age and we say that on a $250,000 home, they can borrow somewhere around $100,000. And with that $100,000, they're free to do with it what they like. They can't take $100,000 all in one lump sum. They must take it in increments. You're only allowed to borrow 60% of the entire eligibility number at the beginning. And the reason they've done that is because FHA and HUD have found in the past that people who have taken everything they're eligible for immediately tend to spend it faster and tend to go right through it much faster than those who are a little bit more judicious with their money because they're not getting it all at one time.
I want to be sure I understood this correctly. So in the example you gave, house worth $250,000, they're eligible, given those ages, to get $100,000. But of that $100,000, they can only get $60,000 immediately?
In the first year, correct. In the first year. Yes, yes.
Okay, and after the first year, they could get immediately the other 40?
The other 40% becomes available, yes, okay. Yes.
Are there any restrictions on what you can do with the money?
No, none at all.
So you could pay off a loan, you could go on a trip, you could buy a refrigerator.
Yep, you can use it to help groceries. A lot of people just use it just to ease the monthly burden that they're under right now with pharmaceuticals, with drugs, with groceries, with other expenses. They use it as a supplement. But yes, we do see people using it for vacations. It just depends on your circumstances at the time and what you would need the extra boost for.
Is the interest rate that is charged higher, lower, or about the same as a corresponding interest rate for a traditional mortgage?
It's about the same. There are two different types of reverse mortgages, one that includes an adjustable rate and one that includes a fixed rate. Hmm. Now, let me explain the differences. With a fixed rate, the interest rates are somewhere slightly higher than what's currently going on with the current 30-year fixed rate. But with a fixed rate, with a reverse mortgage, you're limited to what's called a lump sum disbursement, where you must take one payout at one time, and that's 60% of what you're eligible for. You take it, you walk away with a fixed rate, and there's your money. You're leaving 40% of your eligible equity on the table. You're walking away from it saying, I don't want to touch it. I'm taking the lump sum, and I'm walking
away. You're never going to take the other 40%?
You're not allowed to if you take a fixed rate product. If you take an adjustable rate product, then you're allowed, again, like I mentioned before, to take 60% of the eligibility and the remaining 40% a year later. Most people, when they take an adjustable rate, are looking at it from a standpoint that they want to take money over a long period of time, and they don't want to take 60% right away. They want to take out a $500 a month or $1,000 a month, and they take it out as they need it, or they take a payment. They can take a payment. Say, I want $500 a month to come to me for 60 months.
So for people who are taking note of these numbers, the $250,000 example would mean that if you insisted on a fixed rate, that you would only get $60,000 out of a $250,000 house.
Correct.
But for those who are willing to go with an adjustable rate, then they can that will move about over time. What, for example, now would be the adjustable rate?
The current adjustable rate on a one-year adjustable reverse mortgage is 4.3%.
Now, is there a ceiling on how high that rate can
Great go? Question. There's a 5% cap. That's a 5% cap over the start rate. So in a worst-case scenario, that 4.3 could turn into 9.3. However, there's adjusters built in to that cap, which say you can't take any, you can't increase the loan. The lender can't increase the interest rate by any more than 2% in a given year. So for it to fully extend out to 9.3, it would take 3 years of adjustments to get there. The rate can go no lower than what's called the margin. So every adjustable rate has a fixed portion to it, and the fixed portion is called the margin. So for instance, if an interest rate is 4.3 and the margin is 1.5, we take 4.3 and subtract 1.5, and we say that the LIBOR index that was being used is at 2.8. We add 2.8 to the margin, and that gives us the interest rate. And this adjusts once a year. There is a monthly adjustable interest rate. Their interest rate is, let's say, 4%. It's lower, but it has a 10% cap. And most people right out of the box just choose not to get involved with an interest rate that has a 10% cap. The benefits don't outweigh the deficit.
And is there any prepayment penalty if the person takes out this loan and decides in 3 years they want to?
No, that's a great question, Joe, because that is probably in the application package and the closing package. The borrower is probably reminded three different times that they have the right to prepay, no prepayment penalty whatsoever. You can actually make a payment on a reverse mortgage while you have it, or you can pay it off in full, but no prepayment penalty.
So the good news about these relatively low ceilings that people can borrow against their house is that it leaves a back door available. There's no danger of them getting debt that is such a high percentage of the value of their property that if they decide it's a mistake, that they can't readily turn and qualify for a traditional mortgage to pay it off or other resources.
Right.
So that's the upside of this. Some people are listening and thinking, boy, those ceilings are low. You can't get out a lot of money. And I think they sound a little bit low, but I understand your argument why that is. It's protective of the consumer in large part. But the good news is it means that if you're in it 3 years and you decide rates have gone in a direction I don't like and I don't like the idea of paying this 8 or 9%, then you have a relatively low amount to pay off from whatever source those monies might come, whether it's a family member or whatnot. And there's no penalty for that.
Right. No penalty whatsoever.
I wonder, do people get confused as that this is a loan, another loan? I mean, it seems like when I talk to just the average person on the street, they kind of just think reverse mortgage, and it's just a way to help them stay in their home. But they, I'm not sure that they all are making the connection that this is another loan that has to be paid back. They think I can live there and get my money and not have to pay anything.
And Susan, the one way around that, the one way that we try to remind the consumer that it is a loan, is that before anyone can do a reverse mortgage, they must seek out independent counseling. So they do a counseling session with someone who's not the bank, who's not the government, who is a licensed counselor that will counsel them and discuss with them the virtues and the detriments of a reverse mortgage and the ins and outs. Do they understand that this is a loan? That's one of the primary objectives of the counseling is, do you understand that this is a loan? Because the government doesn't want anybody, neither do the banks for that matter, want anybody entering into a reverse mortgage not understanding what the terms are of the loan. It is a loan.
And this is a rule, in fact, by HUD, right, that this counseling has to take place for their HUD-insured loans?
Correct. The lender, upon introducing the product to the consumer, must provide a list of certified counseling agencies, a list of 11 different counseling agencies. Some must be local. Some can be national. And then it's up to the consumer to pick the counseling agency. We can't say, oh, call XYZ counseling agency. You must choose on your own, independent of the bank, a counseling agency to seek out your counseling. And they vary greatly. Some produce a counseling certificate where they pass your eligibility very easily, and others are more stringent. So it depends on the counseling agency that's doing the counseling.
Let's take a break, come back, and let's talk about who are the people who are most likely to benefit from this sort of product. What implications does it have for their estate planning, which, of course, it does impact that plan in some ways. So I also like to make a disclaimer that I always do whenever I have guests on the show, and that's to make clear to our listeners that anybody we have on the show, we have no financial relationship with whatsoever. We try to choose guests based on their knowledge and their value and their utility to our listeners. So I know that there are radio shows who have guests on, and their purpose is to promote the guest in some financial way. And I'd like for our listenership to know that our loyalty is to you and guests like Bill Nass, the certified reverse mortgage professional from Gershman Mortgage, is here because we're convinced that he is the most authoritative guest we could find to talk about this topic. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
We're back. Today we're talking about reverse mortgages. We have Bill Nass, who's a certified reverse mortgage professional with Gershman Mortgage. Well, we've talked about quite a bit about how mortgage works, how it's calculated, et cetera. Now let's shift gears and talk about who are the people who tend to benefit most from reverse mortgages.
Joe, it can really be a number of different people that can benefit. It can be those who have trouble paying their property taxes. They need a little extra boost to pay their property taxes. Those who need a little extra money in order to meet their pharmaceutical needs. Those that just have trouble making ends meet at the end of a month, or those who want to use it for leisure activities. So it really is a variety of different ways. But the primary candidate that comes to us is feeling some sort of a pinch in their life. They're falling short a little bit in their monthly expenses, their monthly in revenue, and they need something. They need a little help.
Well, and we know from the requirements, which we talked about before the break, is the insured product that's insured by HUD. In order to gain that additional benefit, which accrues to lower costs, et cetera, for the consumer, it means that age 62 and older are the people we're going to be talking about here, right?
Correct.
If anyone who's not in that group wants a product, it would have to be through this new proprietary product that doesn't have the sort of governmental insurance that comes with these.
Correct. And what we're seeing so far with the proprietary products is 60 years is the minimum age. So
really?
Someone
so
who's 55 is got to wait.
This is not a product for a 40-year-old.
This is not a young man's product.
Okay. So then the people we know, because they're older, we can speculate that often would it not relate to long-term care costs or health care costs?
You know, not so much. But in terms of longevity in the house, we see that. We see people using reverse mortgage funds to make the house to able to live in place, age in place, put in a walk-in bathtub, or bring the laundry services from the basement, bring them upstairs.
Or to pay for in-home health care.
In-home health care is another one, correct.
But your point is, you wouldn't use this product to pay for some sort of institutional care, like skilled nursing care, because you'd have to move out of the house, which itself would trigger the money being due.
Correct. And we see that a lot. We get calls from people who are already in skilled facilities looking, and they haven't sold their home. Their home is still sitting there, and they want to use the equity out of their home, and they just can't. They have to be living there in order to utilize the reverse mortgage.
How long do you have to sell your home before the money is due?
That's a good question. According to the letter of the law, you have 6 months to sell your home, and then according up to the lender has the right to extend in 180-day increments if they want to. They don't have to, but typically, if you can show good faith that you're trying to actively market the home, and usually that's by saying I've got a contract with a real estate agent, they'll extend beyond the 6 months. But the letter of the law says 6 months, and then 180-day increments following that.
So I can see where people who are thinking that their primary objective is to age in place. They want to stay in their home as long as they can. And that describes a recent survey done by ARP indicated that like 90% mm-hmm. or so of people who are older than 65, that's their objective. So whenever they turn to a product such as a reverse mortgage to help them achieve that end, it's good to know that there is a back door if it turns out that that plan doesn't work out. And that's a critical component. We made brief reference to it a while ago, but I like this product in that scenario because it does allow for the fact that there's unknowns. And a person might take out this loan, do the improvements on their house, have the full intention of staying there for the next 30 years, and 3 days later, after all these things are completed, they have a stroke. So suddenly they're going into long-term care. Now, it's important for people who are developing a plan to realize that when a catastrophic event occurs like that, as notoriously it does as we get older, then we want to know that there's an alternative course that's not punitive. And in this case, there is, meaning the house can be sold, the interest that is accumulated, which at that point could be very little, can be paid off, and there's no penalty associated with that early payoff, which we discussed again before the break.
Correct. And one other thing we haven't talked about, you mentioned interest. On a typical or a regular traditional home loan where you're making a payment, you can deduct the interest on your taxes. With a reverse mortgage, you can't do that because you're not paying interest. But at the end of the day, when you finally pay the reverse mortgage off and you're paying all that accrued interest off, then there is a large interest deduction that's available either to the homeowner or if the homeowners have died, that gets passed on to the heirs.
I'm curious, roughly what percentage of the clients you've had over the years end up having their home paid off through their estate or after they've passed versus being paid off while they're alive? And I guess the while they're alive scenario would be either that they've moved voluntarily or they've had to move into some sort of institutional care. I'm curious what percent end up not paying it off while they're alive at all and they pass and then it's paid off through the estate, I assume.
I'm not following you,
Joe. Or through the sale of the property. Well, in other words, whenever you take out a reverse mortgage,
right,
you technically don't have to pay it off until you either move or you die.
Right.
Die in the house, so to speak.
Right.
I'm curious what percent die in the house, so to speak.
Oh, okay. You know, it's probably somewhere around 50% is probably what we see. Now, it depends on the situation, too. If it's a couple, oftentimes the remaining spouse will try to stay in the home, but it's not always practical, especially if some of the income is lost through Social Security, one less Social Security check coming in, it becomes difficult for them to stay in the house. But I'd say somewhere around 50%.
But that's an important point to raise, is if you have a husband and wife, they would want to be sure and take out that loan jointly. Because otherwise, I assume, if one spouse died, and the other is otherwise in the home and would prefer to stay there, they presumably wouldn't have the right to do that if they were not, if they hadn't taken out this loan and placed the house as security. Is that true?
Correct. Correct.
So you'd want a husband and wife to both sign on it.
Yes.
That way, when one passes, it's really last to die, right?
Right.
Effectively.
Correct.
It's a last to die rule.
Last one out. Now, there is a provision where someone can be what's called a non-borrowing spouse. So you have a married couple. And the only scenario that where that is true, where that holds true, is you have someone who is under the age of 62. So you've got a husband, let's say, who's 70 and his wife is 60. To do a HUD-insured or a federally insured reverse mortgage, we have to base the criteria or the requirements of how much equity they're going to be able to obtain based on the younger of the two. So we take it off the 60-year-old. But the rule is the 60-year-old who came into this reverse mortgage underage cannot utilize the benefits of the reverse mortgage if the borrowing spouse passes away. So let's say they have a $100,000 line of credit. They're using it. The husband passes away. And now who's remaining is the non-borrowing spouse. The rule used to be the non-borrowing spouse had to pay the loan back and get out of the house. That was pay the loan back and then be on their way. Now they can stay in the home, but they can't touch any of the assets. So if they have $60,000 remaining on that line of credit, but they weren't 62 when they entered into the agreement, they can't draw on the benefits. They can stay in the house, but they can't draw on the benefits.
It doesn't matter if they've aged up.
No. You have to technically then refinance.
At
the moment they sign the agreement, correct.
Mm-hmm. All right, so our listeners understand this. You can't be a co-borrower in that example you gave because you're not 62, right?
Right.
And you have to be 62 to be able to have the HUD-insured product, which is what most lenders are going to provide and what most borrowers would want, I presume. So why would they not, in the scenario you describe, within weeks or even days of the person passing, just go ahead and pull the rest of the money out?
Well, that can happen. That can happen. But oftentimes there's not enough advance warning to know that. But if someone falls significantly ill, that person has to make the request themselves. So the person who's fallen ill, if they can't make the request for that to get that remaining funds, that they don't get the remaining funds.
But there would be a durable power of attorney in place, presumably, right?
Unless the power of attorney was invoked at the time they took out the reverse mortgage, then the durable power of attorney could make a request for the funds. But if
really?
Not, yeah, if
that's
not,
an important point.
That would be very
that's
important.
Tricky because that's contrary to what the law would normally assume. But if you had a provision in a contract that forbade it, but it would still have to be consistent with the statute in Missouri. So I'm curious about that. But anyway, so people are on the alert that potentially a durable power of attorney, even if given to the spouse who was not a co-borrower, because the spouse was under age 62, that may not empower that spouse or a third party to invoke this access to the money.
Right, exactly.
Huh.
Yeah.
It's a complicated discussion sometimes.
It can be.
But on its face, though, I get it. It's a means by which you can safely plan to stay in your home, give yourself money to accomplish that, not have to make any payments. And if things go as planned, you'll die in that home, and then the house will be sold through the estate or whatever thereafter. But yet, in the event that things go sideways and you have a stroke or you have a fall or something requires institutionalization beyond 1 year, you're allowed to be out of the house for 1 year during the course of rehab or whatnot. Then you can sell the house, pay off the existing debt at that point. And whatever's left, of course, belongs to that person.
Right. They can keep the profit from the sale of the home.
So, lots of things to think about. So tell me what else. What are the other common scenarios that you see among people who are drawn to this product?
You know, we see occasionally it's becoming more and more popular as gifting, where the grandparents will draw money out in order to gift their children or their grandchildren. And one of the reasons is they'd like to experience the joy of watching their grandchildren or children enjoy the money while they're alive. Instead of getting the money, which they may get eventually after they've died, the grandparents can bequeath the money or give the money away while they're alive and get to see their grandchildren buy their first car or help pay for that tuition. We see the gifting coming into play quite a bit.
I could see use for that.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting, Joe and Susan, is reverse mortgages can be used to purchase homes. It's becoming more and more popular as a means to purchase homes for seniors, especially those who are coming out of a situation where they're selling their existing home. Let's say they've sold their existing home that was free and clear for $300,000, and they want to downsize now to a $200,000 home. Instead of taking $200,000 of their $300,000 and plunking it down on a new home, they can put down 60% of the value of the new home. So they put down $120,000 on the new $200,000 home, and the remaining $80,000 becomes their reverse mortgage. And now they're going to be charged interest and mortgage insurance on that $80,000, but they're not making a monthly mortgage payment. All they're doing is paying property taxes and homeowners insurance, and it's becoming more and more popular.
Now, re-explain that again. Just because I want our listeners to understand this process. Okay. It sounds like a very clever idea.
It's definitely innovative.
Especially to downsize.
Yes, especially to downsize. So you have someone who has just sold their $300,000 home, and they want to downsize and do a $200,000 home. Instead of taking all two-thirds of the money that they just got from the sale of their home, they take 60% of the value of the new home, or more, if or less if they're older. I'm talking about someone who's 62, puts down 60% of the value of the home. They can borrow the remaining 40. So they put down 120, and then the $80,000 that they would have otherwise had to have put down in order to buy the home now becomes their reverse mortgage. And that reverse mortgage, of course, doesn't require a payment.
That's interesting. That's a clever idea that I'm sure many people have never thought of. And I see the advantages to it.
And so what we're doing, Joe, is we're trying to make a concerted effort to make the real estate community aware of this product. It's difficult to get it out, to conceptualize it in a 30-second commercial on TV or a radio ad. So now what we do is we work with real estate agents to help educate a real estate agent as to the virtues of a reverse mortgage for purchase.
So we have a few minutes left. And this may be a subject that you don't get involved in very much, but I'm curious to get your thoughts. How receptive are other family members? I can see where this does affect an estate plan, and it may be perfectly consistent with the goals of some clients, but it certainly is different. And I wonder to what extent maybe the adult children may support it or not so much support it. What feedback do you get?
I would say in two-thirds of the case, or maybe more, the children are supportive of the family or the parents doing this. We oftentimes hear from the borrowers themselves, oh, my kids are doing well enough that they don't need my house. They don't need the profit from my house or the proceeds from the sale of my house. They're doing well enough on their own that they want us to do this for themselves. And we also have family who oftentimes they're the ones, the family members, the children are the ones who initiate their parents getting involved with a reverse mortgage because they've been helping them out and they're getting tapped out helping their parents. Mm-hmm. So now let the parents help themselves by doing a reverse mortgage. So it's very positive for the most part. You do have occasionally a situation where a child is concerned about their inheritance and is worried that if a mom and dad have a reverse mortgage, that there's going to be less equity left over at the end of the day. And that's true. There'll be less equity left over at the end of the day if they do a reverse mortgage as opposed to if they don't. And some of those children are disappointed with what they may or may not get.
Well, here's my answer to that. They worked for it. They get to use it.
You see those bumper stickers I'm leaving on my kids' inheritance. Hey, well, let me make this point, too, that coming from my perspective, we have literally a minute left, is that really, though, to equip the home in such a way to have the resources to do that, can actually increase significantly the chances that they stay in the home and spend far less money than they would otherwise have spent in institutional care. So I can imagine where this can be a technique by which you enable someone to stay in the home where they otherwise would have been in institutional care at $5,000 to $10,000 or more a month.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. Definitely.
So, Bill, time has flown. Of course, it did last time, too. So we didn't get to all the topics that I'd hoped we'd talk about, but I know that what we have talked about is very useful to a lot of our listeners. So before we wrap up, Susan, do we know what our topic is next week?
Know.
No? Okay.
Not off the top of my head.
All right. So.
Oh, yes, I do. Financial planning with retirement planning. We're going to be talking with another guest talking about how to save for retirement and the money that you need to use.
This is the reason Susan gets the big bucks for this show. In any case, another wonderful episode, I hope, of Elder Talk. Until next week, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.